Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio on rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. You know, the unknown universe is starting to get very large. As I'm getting older and my body is getting smaller, the unknown universe is starting to expand, the great expanding unknown universe. You ever notice that only the aged philosophize about youth, as the young are too busy living it up? I'd like to acknowledge WNAH. It's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. Hoyt's the station manager. He hasn't taken a day off in 9 years, and then before that he doesn't know. He cannot not take a day off. I've seen him through sickness, injury, accident, and you know what? He always makes it into work and hasn't missed a day. Isn't that amazing? That just amazes me. To me, if it was a really nice day and I was feeling really good, why waste it at work? Let's go to the beach. And Tony.
Well, see, that would require that he would have to delegate some authority to someone else and trust someone to carry things and so forth, so that he could have a day off. And some people find that more difficult than just showing up themselves.
The problem is, Harold, he's got nobody else there. Tony is a contract employee who's the salesman, and he's adamant about doing any kind of work. He does anything he does there other than his selling is done reluctantly. So he really doesn't have anybody to assign it to. He can't delegate because it's
yeah.
there. To delegate it. So if he's not there, the show does not go on. Isn't that amazing?
And well, I'm glad he's broadcasting and that we get a chance to serve and offer some public service time and ideas that will help people.
Yes, it's a good work that he's doing. He's helping us, helping you. And that's how the recovery program works. We help each other to accomplish our ends. When we circle up in a meeting, and if I'm called on to close, and we open our meetings with a prayer, and that's called an invocation, we invite in the spirit, and we close our meetings with a prayer, and that's usually called a benediction, and that we agree that through the gratitude that the spirit was among us. And during that closing prayer, I'm called on, we usually circle up in most forms of recovery, NA, CA, and Paranoids Anonymous, except nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings on those puppies. But when we circle up and hold hands, I would say something to the effect that, let this circle represent what we could do together, that which we cannot do for ourselves. Who's father? It's a we program. We do this one-on-one. There's nothing more effective than one alcoholic talking to another, one drug addict talking to another, one addicted person with the same form of addiction talking to another. That's more than all the literature. That's more than all the meetings. That's the thing that works the best. We found that out in 1935, and it's still true today. One drunk talking to another. We use an icon. You're familiar with the icon, aren't you, Harold, the man on the bed?
Yes.
Well, the man on the bed, yeah, that's a depiction. I think it was painted in 1955, and it's a quasi-depiction of Bill W., who was our founder, and Dr. Bob, who was our co-founder, going to the hospital to see if they can help another alcoholic attain and maintain long-term sobriety. They thought they had, they found something out, like missionaries on a quest. they were going for it. They found something that worked for them, and they wanted to share it. By sharing it, they knew they had the greatest ability for themselves to stay sober. That's what they had discovered. It was like when Marie Curie discovered the X-ray, and Pasteur discovered bacteria. I mean, it was that kind of spiritual discovery. And they go out there, and they go into the hospital. Dr. Bob was sober a whole 18 days. Did you know that, Harold?
Wow. That, yes. Back in 1935, Akron, Ohio?
Yes. He was sober a whole 18 days. He already worked his six steps of the Oxford group. There was six then, because AA really hadn't formed yet, other than Dr. Bob and Bill. And when two or three are gathered with no other affiliation, they can call themselves an AA group. So we have two guys going out. In the mouth of the second witness, the matter shall be established. So you need the two guys to establish the truth of anything. So they go out to Bill D, and Bill D is an attorney. And he's in the hospital there, and that was common to go to the hospital for detox. Otherwise, you would die. So they didn't really let him in at the time under the auspices of an alcoholic, but you would come in under usually mental disorder. It was considered a mental aberration that you didn't have the willpower, the spiritual fortitude, the gumption, etc. They really didn't know how to do it. The medical industry, when they can't find something out and they can't put a finger on it, they kind of just turn their back on it. They don't know what to do with it. They would like to fix it. They would like to help, but they don't have the auspices. They didn't have the understanding. Really, nobody did. It was kind of like, this has been around since man first crushed grapes. I don't know if you know this, Harold, that during the building of the pyramids, the workers were paid, and part of their pay was beer. The Egyptians had fermented the first beer. I think it was called...
Terrific.
I think it was Budweiser. You know, you ever wonder why Budweiser is the number one selling beer? You ever wonder about that? You can order it because you can use a one-syllable word, bud.
Bud.
So no matter how loaded you are, you can always order a bud. And so they go to the hospital, and they tell them about, in the painting, you see Bill, Bob, and wait a minute, I think we might have a caller. Hello? Okay, come on.
You're on the air.
Oh, whoever it was dropped off. That was weird.
Maybe they want to listen in and not talk.
Okay, I was hoping maybe it was Papa Spink. We were supposed to do Papa Spink tonight on an interview from Europe, maybe with the time change or something. He wasn't able to. We didn't hear. It was a no-show kind of deal, so we don't know.
Another factor. We switched to daylight time last night at 2 a.m.
Many factors in the world as we spin around this curve. So they're at the hospital, and they're talking to Bill, and you see the painting, and the fella has got a book in his – the fella in the foreground has a book in his hand. And I studied that picture. The fella on the bed is holding his thumb. That's usually an indication. It's body language of an insecurity. And they're telling him, they're talking to him about how to get sober. Now, a lot of people don't realize, a lot of folks don't realize this is 1935. So the big book isn't published yet. It hadn't even been written yet for another 4 years. The only book that they let you take into the hospital at the time was the King James Version of the Bible. I don't know if they let you take in the Douay, which is the Catholic version, I don't know. But the Bible was the only thing you could take in. So he's got this book in his hand, and he's talking to this fellow. So this is before the big book is the point. And he gets sober. Bill D is number three. Bill D is an attorney. Dr. Bob is a doctor. He's a surgeon. And Bill W. is the chief architect of AA. So if you look at the cast of characters, this thing started with a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief. We're a group.
There you go.
We're a group that normally would not mix. It wasn't, the point is, the big book didn't get Bill D. sober. The big book didn't get Dr. Bob sober. The big book didn't get Ebby sober. What got these guys sober, and in the first 100 or so, 40, I think it really is, but I was at a conference today, this weekend, and there was a historian there, and she alluded that it was really 40 and not 100, but 100 sounded better. Sounded something like an alcoholic, but it came up with, you never ruin a good AA story with the facts. So they started out before the big book, and they were able to attain and maintain sobriety in the AA format of one drunk talking to another with their experience, strength, and hope. And the experience, I put it to you this way, experience is an inventory of our past mistakes. That's how we relate to each other. Strength is the ability to lift or carry. We lift our fellows and we carry the message. That's what keeps us sober. And
yes.
Hope is the belief that our life will continue to improve when we do the next right thing. And that next right thing is not to take that first drink of alcohol, that first hit of crack. Whatever that addiction is, the first one is the one that gets you. I can't do any one. I can't have one Oreo cookie. Don't give it to me unless I can have the bag. And then I want another bag. That's the way I'm wired. For whatever reason, I know my shortcomings. You know what you're capable of. It makes a big difference, too. And hope is the belief that our lives will continue to improve when we do the next right thing. And the next right thing is not to take that first drink of alcohol. To clean house, as outlined in the 12 steps found in our basic text, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. All 12-step programs come from that template. To always trust in God and the process he gave us. That's experience, strength, and hope. And what we share in our meetings is what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what is it like now in a general way. If you get too specific on your thing, on your problems and what's going on, and you give names, all I hear you saying is that you haven't spoken to your sponsor about it. You're using the meeting as a format to regurgitate your personal problems. That's not what meetings are for. Meetings are there to give hope to the newcomer, to reinforce our ability to maintain sobriety through the process of the 12 steps. That's why we go to meetings. Find a sponsee. I also like to acknowledge, any question on that, Harold? You got anything?
Well, that's an excellent reminder, and yes, indeed. Almost every week I get a chance to tell people that the reason to go to meetings is so that we can find someone newer in recovery and give them some assistance. And so before we can give any assistance, we have to go through the steps ourselves. So we need someone to guide us through, and that would be called a sponsor. Or in some other 12-step groups, it's called an accountability partner. I've had some interesting meetings at Celebrate Recovery, which use the same 12 steps, and they take the time to go back and find all the scriptural references that connect that Dr. Bob and Bill W., where they got the 12 steps in the first place. Most of the scriptures are from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. But very interesting to read those,
Harold,
get back to basics.
What I like to think of it this way, and I tell some of the folks, now AA is not a religious organization, and the Big Book is not scripture. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritually enlivened work based on scripture. The rub that we come into is some folks come in spiritually bankrupt. And you could see them. Their eyes are darkened a little bit. You could see them. The eyes are the windows of the soul, make no mistake, until you've really seen the darkness come in where the spirit is on a hiatus. And then you see the light coming back into their eyes as they start grasping a spiritual way of life and through the 12 steps. Bill W. called AA a spiritual kindergarten. So they come in at all ranks and rages of religious and spiritual veneration. And we ask them to is to find something that they can relate to, even if they have to use the group, a group of drunks, or good orderly direction. We hold no specific. I think they go a little bit overboard sometimes. Some people use, you know, things that are real quite profane, things in the natural world. You know, and if it works for them, it's a good way to get started. But you're not expected to stay there. The problem I found is that some people insist on keeping the light bulb as God, and they won't progress from there. Their chances of long-term sobriety, I think, diminish as they refuse to grow spiritually.
As I started, right. I used the group as my higher power, and that worked really well. I also borrowed faith from other people. I had a great sponsor as my first sponsor. He was 6'5", 295. That was a higher power, a power greater than myself. Yeah. And then eventually, by borrowing his faith and his understanding, I began to understand the Bible. So it's been a great journey for me. I don't expect people to start there, but it is fun to talk about the Bible now, and recognize where these steps came from back in 1935. I love getting back to basics. Joseph?
Well, thanks, Harold. This is what the website, rumradio.org, is. The radio show, for the most part, it interviews. It's about getting back to a basics phenomenon. I was at a conference this weekend, our intergroup. And some places don't have intergroups. They have different formats, but we have an intergroup here in Houston, 50 Years of Miracles. It's people helping people attain and maintain long-term sobriety. And some of the miracles are just unbelievable. I believe everybody who's done that is a miracle unto themselves. So when I do the interview, I like some of the big shots. They have the better jokes. But just anybody in the program that has attained a certain level of sobriety is a miracle. A lot of these folks would have been dead if it wasn't for the grace that they had received from taking those actions. I believe God turns towards us when we turn towards Him. We have to take an action. I believe we're saved by grace after all that we can do, not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action. For faith without works is dead. I also want to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the final recovery journals, and it affords us some print space from time to time. And, of course, where would we be without our sponsor and co-host? See, I knock off two birds. With one stone. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., who is a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe how the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. And the families are beset on all sides. Things that morality of our nation and the morality of the world starts with the family. If children are taught correct principles, their chances of having a happy, joyous, and free life are exponential. If there's no one there to teach them those correct principles, they grow up like vacant lot weeds, and they succumb to the world. Internet is part of it. Internet is a good and an evil, depending on how you use it, like anything else in the world. some great stuff on the internet. It gets the word out. It is able to help people. It gives a tremendous amount of access to information. And it also has pornography and seamy things, and people connect up and live in the lust of the body and of the mind and of the and denying the spirit. So that's there too. And you know what? You got to have both. You can't have one without the other. When I do good, evil is present. You know why people have a hard time with that? And I'll tell you why. It's a physical or a temporal law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if we have good on the internet, count on it. There's going to be bad on the internet. And it's probably in a direct proportion to each other. I believe the Pan-Asians have it with the yin and the yang, without having a knowledge of the Savior and Jesus, who is my higher power. They don't have that. But they've realized that there is a balance to everything, and there's a balance to good and to evil. So remember that. So sometimes the best thing you can do, we say the path to hell is paved with good intention. So sometimes the best thing you can do is do nothing, but do it with enthusiasm. Harold?
Hi, everybody. And thank you, Joseph, for that introduction. I really value this hour to help people focus on working with others. It really has helped me. It's been the key to my recovery and the key to my survival early on. It's very important for people to learn how to work with others and to learn how important that is to their recovery, the solidity, the continuity of their recovery. And let me comment on the idea that there's going to be evil around. You mentioned that we don't teach our kids correct principles, and I also want to add to that we don't teach our kids correct behaviors. And one of the ways to teach the best principles is to take things one behavior at a time, what we call in the program doing the next right thing. And if we adhere to those behaviors, working with other people and the guidance of our sponsor, then we will learn the principles behind that. It's way more difficult, especially with teens, to begin with the principle and then expect them to extrapolate all the way down to their behaviors and what they can do this evening and tomorrow about things. Kids really need problem-solving skills, and that's a lot of what I do with the families that I see. I've had a week full of very troubled families, so some kids that are drinking. One boy is involved in criminal behavior, committed a felony, was locked up in JDH, was released after 5 weeks, and it wasn't but about 3 days until he was again involved in criminal behavior, this time taking LSD and carrying LSD in his wallet. So now he's suspended from school for the rest of the year, has to see his probation officer Monday morning. They'll probably revoke him. He'll probably go back to JDH again. Very, very troubled situations, and it's making a series of bad choices. He also models his behavior after his dad, who has spent about 2 decades being a chronic relapser. He knows about the rooms and the 12 steps, and he reluctantly attends, but he was, the root cause is selfishness and self-centeredness, and I was very, very selfish and self-centered. Part of that for many of us drinkers, problem drinkers, is that we get so selfish that their domestic violence comes up. And so it just tears families apart. And then the kids are severely affected when they witness violence in the home. We've got to get our act together and treat each other with love and respect, because it's ruining these kids. This boy is so unhappy, and he's blaming the wrong situation for what he's going through. He thinks it's his mom. She doesn't drink. She's had a steady job. She's been a stay-at-home mom. She did homeschooling. I'm not saying she's a perfect angel, but he's got the wrong impression because she put her foot down and wouldn't tolerate violence in the home anymore. Now, in this boy's mind, she's the bad guy.
Well, so, too late. If you let them get too far afield before try to put the brakes down,
too late.
It's too late.
I worked at a wonderful center in Portland, Oregon, and they said if there's breath, there's hope. You know, this kid is still alive. It's not too late. No.
Well, it might be too late for mom. Mom ain't going to do the trick anymore. Dad's not going to do the trick anymore. You know, actually, you brought something up. It's in the Bible. You spare the extrapolate and you spoil the child. Extrapolate. That's a good word. Spare the extrapolate.
I like it.
And you spoil the child. I think that there's a certain place we don't do that anymore. It's considered an assault. If a parent takes a whack, the teachers used to beat the piss out of you at school. The nuns would wrap you on the wrist. I mean, they would hurt. Man, you would think twice about challenging one of those ladies about anything or not doing what you said. Then we used to send people, okay, he needs to go to the army, so we send them for the military. The military would extract their punishment, usually not verbally, though, physically, although, you know, running around the several hundred yard field for 50 times will definitely cause a lot of pain. And when they scream up nose to nose at you, and these eyes, man, they could come up with words and phrases that would melt you with the word. So, you know, and then these kids are just running wild. So I understand that. So we, you know, sometimes you have to consider a little discipline goes a long way. It could be done lovingly, but it has to be done, and it has to be the earlier you perform that discipline, the less hassle you're going to have later on. That's my opinion. Well, let's get going.
Well, let me add just a little note here that we've found and scientifically validated that giving timeouts works way better than spankings. If it's done properly, if the kid really learns something from the timeout, not just doing time, but before you let your toddler out of timeout, he has to calm himself down, talk about what he did wrong, and apologize and really mean it. So a timeout like that will do way more than a spanking. I've worked with many families where the kids will contemplate hitting, the boy will contemplate hitting his sister. He'll know that he's going to get a spanking if he does it, and he'll say, well, that's a good trade, and he goes ahead and hits his sister. But if he has to lose his iPad or his phone or something that he really likes, he will think more than twice about hitting. Spankings are very ineffective, but the discipline is very effective. And this boy needed an example. He needed a man who was responsible and
we're going kind of far off field here. Let's get back on topic. All right, let's do the
We're talking about a guy who was a drunk and a relapser, and now the boy is following in his tracks. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. I like to start the show off, and we've started halfway down the field with the third step prayer. It's a prayer found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, we do not represent AA. We don't represent NA, CA. I like to say we're closer to Paranoids Anonymous, where no one will tell you the meetings. And after so many hours of listening to the show, you probably think we're connected to Narcoleptics Anonymous. But what I do, one of the first assignments I give my sponsees, once they've agreed that they've had enough pain, sorrow, anguish, and alcohol, and they're willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety. We at the conference, there was a fellow by the name of Reverend Bill W., and he has agreed to let us interview him, and he's got a really great program. Funny, he's a friar, I think. They still have friars, FR, and great program. Interesting guy. I like the way he did the whole. You know him?
It stands for father.
Oh, okay. I thought it was friar. Okay. Well, I asked him how he wanted
friar,
to be
yeah, the Catholic phrase father.
Oh, okay. And he said Bill was fine. So he was humble in that respect. And he had really good things to say. So we're going to be interviewing him in the near future. Once we have that done and they give them Clancy 7 questions to write up. It's really good. It's on the website under the how to find the sponsee tab. You scroll down, print it out. It's all in Word, and carry that around when you're looking for a sponsee. I'll tell people this. A lot of folks are coming in. You can go to the halfway houses. They're always looking for sponsors. They're a little tougher when you go to the halfway houses, the men's center, Salvation Army kind of deal, anywhere where the low bottom drunk is, you're going to find the sponsee. You're going to have to do that much more work. Nice thing about today is they're coming in under their own steam, and I'll put it to you this way. I can go to Skid Row. That I already know. And like Bob and Bill, I can go to the hospital. Now I hear tell they come in under their own steam, washed but not clean, and desperate for simple instruction. The next time this golden opportunity walks through the doors, I will push and shove and help them find their seat so my own recovery becomes complete. Page 89 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, go find a prospect and start working on him. Go get him. That's what it says in the Big Book. That's what we're supposed to do. Go get him. And this is the third step prayer, and I have them called to their lifeline, which is men in the program who have agreed to give them a phone number, and so he can call them anytime in case he's out of town, he can't reach his sponsor, which is more times than not, but he's got a way of talking to another drunk, another alcoholic. See, that's the savior. And then this is the prayer, and I ask him, ask him permission to recite this prayer. One, it gets him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects him up with his home group. This is the fellowship that he's going to relate to. This is where he's going to grow up in public. So he's going to get to know their name, and they're going to get to know his name. The third step prayer encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the fellow he's calling might have been considering taking his first drink of alcohol, and then will decide, probably will not, but we have no guarantees. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen. That's wonderful.
I hear noise coming from your side. Are you moving furniture?
No. I'm just trying to get my laptop to cooperate a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, technology. It's a curse and a blessing all at the same time. Well, tonight,
yes.
It doesn't look like Papa Spink is going to make it. I think it's probably what Harold said. My best guess is that this had to do with the time change might have threw him off. And actually, Carmen, too. Carmen didn't show up either tonight. I spoke to her during the week to do the chat room. She didn't make it either. Well, it happens, folks. but the show must go on, and we got plenty to talk about. So tonight I had a call. I work the Facebook, and I do that mainly because I'm trying to get the word out on Rum Radio. And I have little techniques where I send out a missive introducing people in the program most of the time, it's not perfect, to take a look. Some people look at it and they love it. They think this is as good as sliced bread. Some people refuse to look at it, and they're angry at me for being a messenger. It reminds me of the ancient days when a messenger brought bad news to the king. He would be beheaded. And, you know, but I got good news. We're going to behead you anyway because we don't like the way you approached us. Okay, oh, brother. So I had a lady tonight on Facebook, and she was writing to me that her two children were murdered. That's got to be probably one of the hardest things, circumstances, that a parent can experience.
No doubt about it. It is the most difficult experience that parents work with me about, I know.
Well, the murder, too. And I've lost two of my daughters to the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. And I know that was the hardest thing. I'm a combat veteran and been married several times, and I've been through some horrendous things, some of which actually happened. Not to make light of the situation, but the having your children murdered has got to be even worse than that. I don't know. I'm sure they're quiet. It's all walking in the other guy's shoe. It's relative, but I know it's hard. You lose kids like that. We're not wired. We're not programmed to lose our children. We're programmed to lose our father or our grandfather. And, I mean, you lose your grandfather, you love them, but he's 90-something years old, and it was his time to go. And you understand that's the scheme of things. That's how life works. And he's got to move on. He's got to make room for the next generation. He had his opportunity to do his work, and now he's got to go. So we accept that. But when a child goes before they have an opportunity to live and find themselves and do something worthwhile in their life, it's a big loss. It's a heartache. And this lady was telling me she's suicidal. We had this discussion going back and forth, and of course I'm trying to be nice about it and give her my little information about suicide, what I know and what I don't know, and trying to get it to a professional or try to reconsider on a spiritual basis, reconsider what her children would want for their mother. See, suicide is very, very selfish. It's a selfish act. But the pain is so bad. The scriptures call the pain is exquisite. And I didn't know what that meant until I went to my first daughter's funeral. Then I knew what that meant. The pain was so great, my spirit left my body. And it was hard to breathe. And so I knew what that meant. My second daughter, actually, the pain was bad, but wasn't as bad as the first time. It was like my psyche couldn't go there again and survive. So the grieving for my second daughter was done in more of an increments, where it would come in smaller doses. I think that's from a loving God who does these things for us. So tonight what we're going to talk about, something I give to my sponsees, there's two. We're going to do the suicide. What if my sponsee is suicidal? So we're going to address that. I have a really good little vignette on this. I give out these recovery cards and home groups that I go to. Well, they let me, until I'm banned or something. And I gave one to a fellow one time, and he goes, you know, oh, you gave me one 6 months ago. I says, great. He says, oh, I showed it to my sponsor, and he really loved it. He says, it's all over Dallas. I said, well, you know, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. We're not making any money. I'm anonymous on the site. So this is my payback when I hear something like that it's doing a good for someone else. Hey, I'm good with that. That's great. I think I'm blessed for having the ability and the opportunity to do this. I mean, how crazy is that? If you knew me, that would be pretty insane. I'm not making any money. You know, like, what happened? What happened to this guy? Where'd he go? Where's the real Joseph? Where'd he go? And he said, oh, and by the way, you know where you have on the site about what suicide is, that it's also considered a slip? He says, when I read that, that's when I decided not to kill myself. And I just learned this. A slip is when you go out drinking before you've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Relapse is after you've worked the 12 steps. Do you know that?
I like
that. Yeah. I've never heard that before, but it makes sense now that I've heard it.
Yes, I like that a lot. That's very useful. And the comments that you've included on your website about what if your sponsee is suicidal, this is very good stuff. It's right on the money, very important for people to understand. Suicide is on the rise, and even child suicide is on the rise. So I'm so glad that we can take a minute and talk about these things and what people can do to help someone they know who may be having suicidal thoughts. There's a lot we can do to help, and we don't have to be afraid of this. Go ahead, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I'll, from the website, I have a little vignette of Frankenstein laying on a therapist's couch and the psychiatrist. Dr. Frankenstein has suggested a simple brain transplant. The brain of Abby Normal is available. The only side effect is he could be an alcoholic. And then on below the vignette, it says, the bad news is, the doctor gave you an alcoholic brain.
That's a funny movie.
Yeah. Well, I did part about therapy. First, a little background. This suicide is the sincerest form of self-criticism. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
That is really a gigantic thought right there. That I think that has helped. That phrase has helped more people than any other phrase that I've used over the years. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. You could also remind your sponsee that suicide is also considered a slip. And I have a little thumbnail there on the thing, where a fellow's got, you could see somebody's hand over a sink in the bathroom, and he's got an electric razor against his wrist. And it says,
but
you're doing
Norelco.
It all wrong. Trying to use the electric razor. That's my kind of suicide. There you go. All right.
There you go.
There's no easy answer to this difficult question. Each situation is different. If there is a clear and present danger, you may need to suggest that your sponsee call 911. Otherwise, we have a responsibility to see that a sponsee has told a member of their family, spouse, sibling, or parent about the suicidal feelings, or that they have sought professional help.
Let's pause there for just a second. It's so important for anyone that you're working with as you begin working, find out who their support system is. Find out if they have family members that support them. Find out if they have friends who could be a support. That can be really valuable later, especially if they become suicidal, of course. You can, the only way to ask them if they've talked with a family member is if you know whether or not they have family members. So get some of that information ahead of time. It might come in really useful later. Joseph?
Thank you. A friend of mine, David, he's in Colorado now, and he's tried to commit suicide 6 times. His background, he's highly intelligent, probably manic, my guess is. He walked in on his mother's suicide when he was 12 years old. Mom was in, she had tried several times, comes home from school, goes to the bathroom, there's mom laying in the bathtub. She had slit her wrists and she died. She died in the tub. And the 12-year-old boy walks in upon it. So that scarred him for the rest of his life. Very accomplished guy, you know, brilliant engineer. And he's jumped out of trees. He's jumped off buildings. One time, and this is not all that long ago, in Austin, he had this thought of suicide. He said, it just sounds like something, a little frustration. It could be the smallest frustration or a combination of frustrations, nothing really tremendous. And then the thought to suicide would just manifest itself. And he had the presence of mind to call for help. The only problem is he dialed 411 instead of 911. And then as a true alcoholic and addict, he started arguing with the directory assistance operator that they were wrong and that he really dialed 911. And he's arguing with the directory assistance operator saying, no, I dialed 911. I want 911. He says, look, sir, you know, I'm suicidal. He says, look, sir, this is directory assistance. Can I look it up in number for you? And he wouldn't go that way. He's so insistent that he was correct. You know, that's the ego. You know, I might not always be right, but I'm never wrong. You take that to the bank. So he's arguing with this guy. Well, the nice thing about it, the 411 operator got his address, I guess, from the call and called 911 for him. So by that time, by that time, David had strung an electrical wire off the ceiling fan in his office and hung himself. Well, they broke into the house and they cut him down and he hit a filing cabinet and bruised his ribs. Other than that, he was okay. Isn't that amazing?
That is a great story.
And there's a little bit more to it than that.
People, when they get to feeling so much pain, they become quite convinced that the only way to escape that pain is to take their lives. And so that's basically an overview of suicide. And if you can talk to a person for 30 minutes, often you can save that life. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. The other little side vent is that David had Hep C, hepatitis, and was dying from that viral infection of the liver and had gone through chemotherapy for 18 months. And from what he told me, chemo is like having the worst case of the flu you can imagine every day for 18 months. Some people will opt to die instead of continuing on with the regime. And he did that. He fought that for 18 months, and it didn't work. And because his life was on the line and the virus had gone rampant, he was able to get the Food and Drug Administration to agree to a experimental chemo out of Panama. And they allowed to bring it in. Well, it worked for him. He did another 18 months of chemo on this protocol, and it worked.
Wow.
His bones were depleted. All the minerals were depleted out of his bones, and he still has problems with his skeletal structure because all the minerals have been bled out. Now, the curious thing about it is here's a man trying desperately over many attempts of killing himself. Now he's struggling almost in a superhuman event to stay alive. What's up with that?
That is fascinating.
You know what it is? I know what it is. It's control issues. He had the control to take his life. That's the ego. Something else outside of him, outside of his ego, was going to take his life, and he would have none of it. The body will sacrifice, I say ridicule, because this is the ego. Death to the ego is ridicule. More than anything else, it's one of the main fears of speaking in public is because of the ridicule of ego. The ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanity is a vanity. All is vanity. And the alcoholic and the drug addict is the extreme example of self-will run riot. That's ego. And what is pride? We always say it's the number one deadly sin, right, Errol? Number one, pride.
Yeah,
why
number
pride?
One.
Why? Why pride? What's the hinge pin on pride? Pride is the disavowment of God or the need thereof. You're walking in the sparks of your own thoughts, and you're disavowing or the need for God. It's all about God. And then when the ego says, no, it's not about God, it's all about you. I tell newcomers when they come into a meeting, there's a newcomer in the room and everybody says, you're the most important person in the room. And when I chirp up, I'll say, you're the most important person in the room besides me. And unless this room catches fire, then it's every man for himself. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. So you've got a very nice list here of things to do and think about if a person you're working with says they're suicidal. You said we have a responsibility to see that our sponsee has told a member of their family, so you check about their support system, whether there's a spouse, a sibling, a parent that is a support system for them, and if they or if they have sought professional help. So those are two wonderful things to check. And then beyond, you said the next sentence is important too. Beyond that, all you can do is be available to a response on a responsible basis and turn it over. So calling 911 is sometimes the best thing to do. Finding out about support, family members, siblings, spouses, finding out about professional help, talk to them. But, and I've seen it really help a lot when we just ask very direct questions. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Do you have a means? Have you thought about when you would do it? Do you have a plan? But the question I find most shocking, and that's what we need to do for someone who is so absorbed in their pain and that everything seems black, we need to ask them, who is going to find your body? Sometimes that really helps the person realize there's going to be a dead body at the end of this process. Joseph?
Well, thank you, Harold. Yeah, that's it's a very serious phenomenon, and some of these little tools, you'd be surprised, could save someone's life. The basic guidelines is that you're not in charge of your sponsee's life.
Yes.
The cornerstone of recovery, I call it agency or free will. If you think you could save someone's life, that you can bring back the dead, you're playing God again. And even a decision as profoundly and as important as life or death is your sponsees to make. If they feel that death is a release from alcoholism, which is a solution, it is not in your power to keep someone alive. Once you've taken those steps, you got to kind of let go. No man who is occupied in doing a very difficult thing and doing it very well ever loses his self-respect. George Bernard Shaw. Now, remember, you also have a responsibility to yourself in these cases. Should your sponsee commit suicide, you want to know that you've done everything you could reasonably have done to prevent it. In the tragic event that your sponsee opts for the solution of death to relieve their alcoholism, you don't want to burden yourself with guilt because you did not urge them or to get help or second-guess yourself. That's the big one. You're always going to second-guess yourself in a death. If I only would have done something a little differently and changed that path. If you have done these things differently, ask yourself what behavior would be reasonable under those circumstances. Seek the advice of your sponsor. Do all that you can do and turn the rest over to God. Remember, it's a fool that seeks logic in the chambers of the human heart. There's always sadness at the fall of a comrade. The unfortunate turn of events should not stop us from working with the new man. We remain in action, being of maximum service to God and our fellows, and we let the dead bury the dead. We move on. We can save, maybe we can help save the next guy. This guy is gone. He's out of our purview now. He's with God. And he's got to make his his next sponsor. He's got to deal with God and not with me anymore, so God bless him. I hope it works out for him to the best of his ability. I had a sponsee, not a little vignette, Michael, and big fella, about 300 and 350-pound guy, you know, about 6 foot tall, huge guy. And he was going to the program, and he liked the way I shared. And he had a sponsor, Jack. And Jack was a good sponsor. He had about 6 or 7 guys. Jack did a lot of sponsoring. And he said, you know, I really want you for my sponsor because you won't take any BS. I said, well, you have a sponsor. He said, well, I do, Jack, but I want you. I said, well, I tell you what, before we make any sudden changes, I need to call Jack. And I think that's polite, and I would recommend that to anybody. If somebody wants to do that, you call up his sponsor first before you make any agreement. Two reasons. First, it's polite, because this man has given of his time, talent for this other fella, and just to pull him away like that I think is kind of rude. We should have tried at least maintain the veneer of civility when it comes to interactions in the program. That's my deal. So I called up Jack, and I said, Jack, this is what's happening. What's your take on it? Well, he says, well, you know, the guy's a real pain in the butt. He says, and I got 7 guys right now. Do me a favor. Take them. Okay. The other thing is, when you're talking to his sponsor, you're going to get a little bit of a lay of the land. How far has he gone? What's his stumbling block? You know, so this is really good information. It's valuable to get you started on the right footing and hit the deck running. So we start off like my sponsor sponsored me. Reading out of the big book, giving assignments and things like that. So I didn't know all that much. I knew less than I should have, but we were just at the beginning, so I was okay at the beginning stuff. And we started out, and he was talking in the meetings, and he was doing good, and called me every day. That was part of the deal. He called me every day, and he was calling me on, and, oh, Jack, one of the things to say, this guy's a real pain in the neck. He'll call you 2-3 times a day. He says he's like clockwork. He says, okay, so I'm used to, he calls, and I'm okay with that. So we're talking, and so he's calling me on a Sunday night, and I was in Houston at the time. I was living in Austin, visiting my children, and that was really special time for me. And we were always estranged, so anytime I have quality time with my kids, I don't like to be disturbed. I saw his call came in on a Sunday night, and I opted not to take it. And, of course, I felt bad about it. I should always take the call, but I didn't do it. Okay, so next morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm winging my way back to Austin, and I call him up, and he answers the phone, 7 in the morning. Hi, how you doing? I got your call, but I was tied up. Anything going on? He said, no, it was just a check-in. He says, actually, I'm doing really good. I read your assignment out of the big book. I shared in the meeting, and I had some good news. I just got a contract to do some work. He was a genius when it came to marketing. He had been out of work for a while, and he just got a contract to do some marketing work, and he was excited about that. I said, well, that's great. It almost sounded like it was too good. You know, once you've been a sponsor for a while, you start the sense of smell comes into play. If something sounds too good, it usually is. Anyway, so, okay, but we need to meet Wednesday night, go over some of the stuff, see where we are in the steps. And okay, great. So that was Monday morning at 7 a.m. Tuesday afternoon, the next day, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, his wife calls me and says, you lost another one. Now, she didn't know that, but my oldest daughter had died the year before. So when she said that, it was like, you know, like I'm trying to process. What do you mean? One of my kids are dead? You know, she said her husband, Michael, had drank so much that he went into anaphylactic shock and dropped dead. And this man knew to drink again was to die. So
yes.
From 7 o'clock Monday morning to 2 o'clock Tuesday afternoon, he drank enough to kill himself. So when we talk about suicide, every time you put a drink or drug into your body, you're opting to die and not to live. Harold, got any last comments?
Yes, let me tell a little story about losing one of my clients, not because he drank himself into a state of shock, but he had been secretly drinking quite a bit of beer every day, and he went to Houston to visit his sister, accidentally stopped, had a seizure, and died. And so I'd like to encourage everybody, if you know someone that's drinking heavily, please encourage them not to stop cold turkey. It could cause a seizure and death. So thanks, everybody, for listening. It's really an honor to be able to help a little bit and offer some ideas. There is a suicide hotline, it's easy to get help. If you're having suicidal thoughts or a friend of yours is, don't hesitate to call the suicide hotline. Joseph?
Thanks, Harold. Well, thank you, folks, for listening. I don't know what happened to Papa, but I guess we went over that. It was the second time, so I don't know about these guys from Europe. I'm going to have to give them a train timetable, I think. I wanted to tell you, we're in rumradio.org. We're growing. It's hard getting on the website now because so many people are going on to it. It's slowed down. I'm working on that problem as we speak. It was supposed to have been repaired by Saturday. We might have to go to a new platform to increase the speed of access. Usually a little bit more during the day. This is probably peak time right now. It's good information. It's done by word of mouth. That's how good it is. It's really that good. It's a phenomenon. It's called rumradio.org. It comes from one of the stories in the third edition of the big book, Rum, Radio, and Rebellion. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,700-plus towns, cities, and villages, and probably approaching 270,000, hits to the website. So it's a good work for a good cause. It will help a lot of people. It's a back-to-basics treatment on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the Big Book is sufficient to our needs. Like I said, it's a spiritual, enlivened work based on Scripture. We found that it's worked. It works for many. It works for millions. And it'll work for you, but you got to work it. It works if you work it. Thank you so much for letting us into your home and into your hearts, and like you do the same for us. Thank you again, and we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.